The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. It's good to see you all today. Thank you for coming and joining us on this annual festival Memorial Day for Great Master Dogen. And it's lovely that our introductory retreat guests are able to join us for that as well. And this is an important day for us because we're celebrating the life and teaching and expressing gratitude to Great Master Ehei Dogen. And for those of you who are new here, I will just tell you a little bit about him. Of course, he is the founder of our particular Soto Zen lineage that went to Japan and has come to us in the West from Japan. So he's considered the founder and father, as Reverend Master Mayan said in her dedication, of the Soto Zen lineage in Japan. And so without him and his training, we wouldn't be doing this today. He lived in the 13th century, was born in the year 1200 in Japan, and as the offertory we heard today said, he was born of noble birth, meaning, probably one of the families of the nobility in Japan. And at that time, there was a great deal of political strife, a lot of war between the families in Japan. It was a very, very difficult time to be alive in that country. And so at a young age, Ehei Dogen, Dogen Zenji, as he's called in Japan, experienced already a great deal of suffering. And being a very sensitive and very intelligent young man, saw what cravings for power and wealth and so on and position and property did to people when it went to extremes. And his own father was killed in one of these conflicts at a young age, when Dogen was at a young age. His mother encouraged him in his religious practice and also died, however, when he was a very young boy. And it was this experience of losing his parents at a young age that was one of the chief motivators to his seeking monastic life eventually and sincere training. He trained initially in Japan, wanted to enter monastic life at the age of, he actually was ordained at the age of 14 as a novice monk. And, you know, he was probably, obviously his family would like to have had him as the head of a family, the head of a particular clan and so on, because he clearly had very great abilities. He had a very, very, the finest of education, was very intelligent, a good writer, even at a very young age, could quote and memorize long texts. And yet he seemed to escape from one situation to another, and finally managed to go to one of his maternal uncles, who was the abbot of a monastery, and sought refuge there and asked to enter monastic life. To the uncle's surprise, but eventually realized why he wanted to do it and allowed him to go that route. So he was quite desperate to seek the Dharma and didn't want any part of the suffering, really, that he saw happening in his family and others around him at that time. Seeing impermanence, having insight into the fact that all things are changing, is one of the is seeing into one of the three major characteristics of existence in Buddhism: the fact of impermanence, the fact of no self, no permanent separate self, no selfish self that has any reality, and also the fact of suffering that exists in our lives as humans. And so Dogen's entryway was having a deep experience of impermanence. The fact that not only his family, those close to him were dying and were not a permanent refuge for him, but also seeing all the change around him, he realized that all things truly are in a state of flux. And so this really motivated him to look for that which does last. What is the lasting thing? What is the reality? What is it that doesn't disappear on us? What can we rely on? So he began to study the scriptures. He was training primarily in the Tendai tradition, which was prominent in Japan at the time, on a mountain called Mount Hiei, and was very highly intellectual, and so studied the scriptures, memorized them, was able to write them, was able to write about them at a young age, and yet realized that something was missing, and was also distressed at some of the sectarianism that was going on. People were fighting with each other, different lineages, the followers of different teachers were arguing with each other, and even occasionally going to the extreme of being warring with each other. You know, you have the tradition of the soldier monks of Mount Hiei. It doesn't happen very often in Buddhism, but it did happen there. And he was quite distressed about this and felt that there was something deeper that he needed to find, and was eventually, this led him to a journey to China, where he went to find a true master and what he thought of as an authentic teacher and the authentic Dharma. So he risked his life crossing, of course, very dangerous sea at that time, went with his teacher friend Myo Zen, fellow practitioner in the Rinzai tradition, with whom he was training in that tradition for some time. And they traveled around to all the famous Chan or Zen monasteries in China, in eastern China, for a while, until sadly Myo Zen died eventually, and also Dogen found Zhu Qing, which is the Chinese name for the monk who became his teacher, then Tendo Nyojo in Japanese. And so he then began to realize that he found the authentic teacher that he was looking for, and trained with Tendo Nyojo for a number of years. After 2 years of very diligent training, realized enlightenment, realized the bliss of liberation, and eventually was transmitted by him. And it's through his training and his efforts that this particular lineage of Buddhism went back to Japan and came to us today. So he was the first monk of that particular lineage. So all Soto Zen temples chant his name in the ancestral line that we chant in the morning. We all have his name in our lineage. And then, of course, there might be, as well as Great Master Keizan, who was two generations later. And after that, the lineages, the families, as it were, branch out. So what we chanted this morning, those of you who are here for the retreat, would have been our particular ancestral lineage, including Dogen and Keizan and all the monks after him. He was very serious, very desperate in a way, and that desperation caused him to wish to train very, very diligently. So he was willing to do whatever was necessary to not only realize the truth, but also to bring the true teaching back to Japan. He felt had very keen experience of the suffering of his people. And so rather than going to into political life or into following his father's footsteps, becoming a king or a prince or a regent, Dogen decided the best way to do this was through entering the monastic life and coming to the core of suffering, what the real cause of it was. I'll just quote a little bit from this lovely little book called Soto Zen, that was a translation of a work by Reverend Master Jiyu's master, Kato Chisan Koho Zenji. And And he was also himself a great scholar. We were lucky to have him as our grandmaster. We are lucky to have him as our grandmaster. And many of his works are not yet translated into English. But he says here, it was Great Master Dogen who first brought Soto Zen to Japan. And Great Master Keizan later made possible the popularization of Soto Zen, thereby laying the foundation for the large religious organization which it is today. And I won't repeat some of what I've already told you. At the young age of 15, Dogen was assailed by the following doubt. Both the exoteric doctrines, in other words, all the various teachings of the Buddha that he had been studying, that said enlightenment is inherent in all beings from the outset. They all said this. But if this is so, he wondered, what causes all the Buddhas, past, present, and future, to seek enlightenment if they are already enlightened? This particular doubt, if you like, or his particular question is formalized in our the scripture that we recite daily in the meditation hall called Rules for Meditation, the Fukan Zazengi, which our retreat guest would have recited yesterday, in which he says, if training and enlightenment are differentiated, you know, why? In other words, if there is already no difference, why do we need to bother training? You know, what is the reason for training? And Kedo Chisan says, such a doubt, clearly pointing to the dualistic contradiction between the ideal and the actual, is a kind of anguish likely to arise in the mind of any deeply religious person. Unable to resolve this great doubt on Mount Hiei, Dogen decided to study Buddhism under Great Master Eisai, Myo Zen, and so on, and eventually made it to Tendo Nyojo, as I mentioned. So this was his particular doubt, his particular question. And so I'd next like to look at the fact that the training, the tradition, the whole lineage, or the tradition of Buddhism, comes out of the training of the person. And that's always an interesting fact. It's important to remember that with regards to the Buddha, the whole of Buddhism has come out of his training and his realization, his particular koan, the answer to his koan of suffering. And our tradition has come out of Dogen's koan in that sense, in one sense. And it's helpful to remember that, because in that sense, each of us, as we look at our own particular koan, and when we say koan, we mean our particular suffering, our particular karma, the sort of paradoxes that we experience, what creates suffering for us. Each person has to get to know that. And as we resolve that, as we work with that, we begin to find not only liberation for ourselves and for others. And so these traditions, these great practices are created out of individual people's training. And I find that really important to keep in mind, and also brings a lot of inspiration and hope, I think, for us, and the effect that we might not always see, but definitely has on others around us, both in the present life and in our future life, and also in healing karma from our past lives. Obviously, he was a deeply sincere person and very, very determined. And he was also, quite judgmental and had his problems, was very intellectual. So his teachers were always trying to point him to beyond just the thinking mind. And he had a number of teachers before he met Ju Qing, and of course they all helped him along the way. But when he met, the Japanese name, Tendo Nyojo, he realized that this was what would help him to resolve his doubt. In this book, Dogen's Formative Years in China, there's a wonderful translation of the Hokyoki, which is Great Master Dogen's conversations with his master, or recorded conversations with his master that he kept personally. He did not publish this and didn't give it to anybody. It was found after his death. So it's sort of a diary that he kept of some of his perhaps most of his important conversations with Tendo Nyojo. And I had, when I was on retreat last April at one of our hermitages, I had the great benefit of having the time to read this thoroughly, and I found it deeply moving to see Dogen in this context, in the context of the master-disciple relationship, and see him as a trainee. And I won't quote it all. He has a lot of questions. Of course, he had studied a great deal, so he has all these long intellectual questions, and his master is always pointing him back to the simple practice, to the practice of the precepts, and to the practice of meditation. Here's one little quote from this. At one time, Ju Qing, or Tendo Nyojo, his master remarked, "Although you are a young man, you possess the ancient manners." So Tendo Nyojo took a real liking to him, obviously, and allowed him to come to his quarters whenever he wanted to ask questions, which was a great privilege because he was the abbot of a huge monastery with many, many monks there. And so for a foreigner, you know, in China at that time, to be allowed to do this was quite remarkable. Tendo Nyojo goes on to say, "You must immediately make your dwelling in steep mountains and dark valleys." And this is something he did later. "And nurture the sacred embryo of the Buddhas and patriarchs for a long time. You will surely reach the experience of the ancient virtuous ones." Thereupon Dogen rose and prostrated himself at the great monk's feet. Tendo Nyojo recited the nature of both the worshipped and the worshipping is void, is pure, unstained, and clean. In other words, the one bowed to and the one who is bowing, the nature of these are both pure. And in between is the spiritual correspondence and the permutation of the way, which is beyond intellectual comprehension. Then Ju Qing, or Tendo Nyojo, expounded at length on the daily activities of the Buddhas and ancestors of India and China. Dogen was deeply moved, and the tears moistened his sleeves. And throughout this diary, he expresses his times when he just was overcome with gratitude and moved to tears when he heard his master's teaching. Clearly, he was finding the answer to his great question and his great doubt and his suffering. So one of the hallmarks of the teaching that Dogen brought back to us is this gratitude. The Four Wisdoms, of course, are very important to Soto Zen training and to Buddhism: charity, tenderness, benevolence, and wisdom, the cultivation of these. And in our particular tradition, the practice of gratitude and of bowing is emphasized in particular as a special sign of enlightenment in our tradition. And this was something that Dogen clearly manifested. And when his teacher pointed through the confusion that he was experiencing, he always expressed gratitude. And this is a very great quality to keep in mind. We may not all have a teacher such as Tendo Nyojo, but we all have the teacher in a sense that we need. We all find the Dharma in our daily lives. If we're fortunate enough to have contact with a teacher, we can hear the Dharma in that way, but the teacher will only point us to the Dharma that is in our hearts and that will appear in response to our own koan throughout our daily lives. So Tendo Nyojo was in particular very interested. He taught a very rigorous form of Zen, and in particular taught the just sitting meditation, which had been passed on from the time of the Buddha, really, to Bodhidharma through many of the Chan masters, and it was particularly emphasized the harmonization of training and enlightenment, and this really appealed to great master Dogen. So I'll just look at a couple more quotes from that from his teaching so that you can see how this was passed on to him and to us all these centuries ago. Zhu Qing said, "To study meditation under a master is to drop the body and mind. It is the single-minded, intense sitting," which is what our meditation is called. Shikantaza means single-minded, intense sitting, or just sitting, not doing anything else. So without burning incense, worshiping, reciting the Buddha's name, practicing repentance, nor being attached to reading the sutras. In other words, all these practices are wonderful, but all of them are encompassed also within the meditation practice, within the just sitting. So Dogen asked, "Well, what is the dropping of the body and mind?" And Zhu Qing replied, "To drop the body and mind is to sit in meditation. When practicing single-minded, intense sitting, the five desires will depart and the five defilements will be removed." So I won't go into the details of that, but essentially, he encouraged Dogen, as we do in our meditation practice, to trust that this practice, in fact, cuts through all of our greeds and our angers and our delusions and all the problems and confusion, the suffering that results from them, because it immediately puts us in touch with that which is real within us, the true Buddha nature. So Dogen asked, "If we depart from the five desires and remove the five defilements or confusions, this teaching would be the same as the discussion of the scripturalists." You know, he's always comparing with what he had just been learning in Japan. "Are we not then the practitioners of both Mahayana and Hinayana?" Mahayana is the, Hinayana is perhaps not a polite title to use these days anymore, but essentially is a reference to a tradition in Buddhism earlier on that's probably died out by now, actually, but emphasizes more the attaining of enlightenment at all costs, the individual attaining enlightenment. And the Mahayana developed into broadened the practice to include and embrace all beings and to encourage the bodhisattva ideal of making the training and possible for all beings, regardless of where they come from and who they are. So broadening that. Zhu Qing replied, "The descendants of the first ancestor should not reject vehemently the teachings of Mahayana or Hinayana." In other words, not the later school or the early school. Don't reject these teachings. As Dogen had in his mind that he had to sort of reject everything. It was somehow somewhere else. The teaching, the true Dharma, was somehow in another place. So his master is saying, don't reject it. But if you turn away from the sacred teachings, in other words, of the Tathagatas as a student, how can you call yourself a descendant of the Buddhas and ancestors? So he's saying, you don't have to reject it, just go on from it. You know, just find out for yourself, make it true for yourself through the meditation practice. And this, of course, something that we all tend to suffer from is, if this is good or if this is right, then the other thing must be wrong, you know, somehow. And so he's constantly throughout this diary pointing Great Master Dogen to going beyond the opposites. This is all very fine. What you've studied so far, what's useful, you know, will come back to you. Just move on from it and now penetrate to the heart of it and harmonize the study with experience, with your daily life. And that was one of the great teachings to Dogen. And as you've been hearing this weekend, those of you who are new, this is still, to this day, very much emphasized in our practice, this harmonization of the Dharma, the scriptures, and our experience in our meditation with our daily lives. And this is one of the hallmarks of the Soto Zen school, or if you like to call it school in particular. But in a sense, that's not a term that Great Master Dogen used, because again, his master and he very much felt that it was not helpful to split Buddhism up so much into various categories. There are different practices, and there are different cultures and different personalities among the teachers and so on, but fundamentally it's all Buddhist practice, and many, many problems occurred in China and in Japan, and probably before that, when Buddhism became too sectarian, when the various traditions became too isolated from each other and eventually became competitive. There were a number of schools of Zen at the time, and Dogen himself and his master refused to strictly identify with only one of them. Although the Chaodong, the Zaodong, and which became Soto Zen in Japan, was their primary lineage, they did not see themselves as separate from the other traditions of Zen and used teachings from them, as well as from, as Tendo Nyoja was saying, from the early Theravada teachings as well. And this, again, I think is one of the hallmarks of Dogen's teaching, is that it has a universal appeal, and certainly the meditation practice that he taught is something that is really ultimately accessible to people of any religion and of any background. It doesn't involve using words necessarily at all when you're sitting, right? So it's a very, very great practice, very great teaching in that sense. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. It gives you a little bit of a sense, perhaps, of how Dogen was taught by his master. He only trained with him for 2 years, very intensively. I think he was very aware, again, of the law of impermanence and how short things, you know, how fleeting everything was. So he made very good use of his time with his master. And as it happened, Dogen only lived to the age of 53 and packed an awful lot of training, living, writing, teaching into that amount, that time, and left us with great volumes of wonderful teachings. The largest of which is, of course, as you may have heard this weekend, those of you who are new, the Shobogenzo, 95 chapters of this, basically transcribed talks of Great Master Dogen's that were recorded by one of his disciples. And all of this we have, in fact, online. And also, if you're interested in exploring commentaries on some of that, we have a book that's available up in the on the Donna shelves in the guest house, called Roar of the Tigris, Volume 2, which is Reverend Master Jiu's, some of her lectures on some of Great Master Dogen's Shobogenzo chapters. And it's edited by the former head of our order, one that Reverend Master Daisui, who sadly died of cancer a few years ago. So that's a very good work for understanding Dogen's Shobogenzo a little better, because that particular work is very deep in its expression of Buddhism, but sometimes very, very difficult to understand. One has to, and you may have been told this, but it has to be read very much from the mind of meditation. Obviously, it's helpful to understand the vocabulary and to perhaps look at some of the references, cultural references, as well as particular references to Zen stories, and Reverend Master Hubert does a lot of referencing in the this Reverend Master Hubert is our translator monk who isn't here today, who published this large work on our, and it's not, which is now on our website. So there are references that are helpful to know about, but ultimately the best way to penetrate the these works is to just read them from the mind of meditation, as if you were just sitting and listening to the rain, perhaps, is what I find. Something like that, just to suspend the intellectual mind, because it's going to get frustrated very, very quickly. And that, again, is one of Great Master Dogen's specialties, and particularly in that work, is he looks at a situation, at a particular teaching or a particular Zen story. He uses a lot of Zen stories from the past, Zen koans of various masters and disciples. And he looks at it in a particular way and brings out the traditional interpretation of it, but then he'll turn it upside down and look at it another way. And then he'll turn it sideways and look at it that way and turn it the other way around and turn it back again. He comes around full circle to the beginning. And if you stay with him through that, if you're just meditating with him through that, you begin to start realizing that he's thinking completely out of the box. I mean, totally and absolutely. There's not a box there to begin with. And he encourages us to do that, you know, to not get stuck with opinions, interpretations, intellectualization, the analytical mind, for that matter, even the intuitive mind, which can go awry if it doesn't have guidance. All of these things that we kind of, ways of perceiving things that we kind of attach to, yeah? And he helps us to go beyond them and keeps us moving all the way through it until we, you know, the mind is opened and we begin to see something at the heart of it and see that there are also different aspects of the teaching, not just one one teaching with many aspects, like a great jewel with many, many facets. So that's one of his specialties. So don't be surprised if you're reading some of his works and find them completely not understandable. When I first started reading Dogen, when I came here, I certainly had that experience, but we were asked to, as a monk, young monk, we were asked to read certain things on a regular basis during our reading periods, such as his work on existence, time, flow, Uji. And I frankly didn't understand any of it, but I found myself strangely drawn to it, and so would just read it during the reading periods, as we would read the precepts and other more practical instructions that also great Master Dogen has written down for monastic trainees and monastic communities. But I did find that somehow, even though I didn't understand it with my brain, that it was life altering. It had an effect on me that was positive. I would walk away from the reading and I would feel, on one level, just feel better. You know, it would just somehow take me beyond my limited view. And I couldn't have explained it, and even now I would have some difficulty explaining some of that. But I can tell you something of my experience with it, and it would brighten my mind. So I found that, always find that very interesting, that one has to take in the Dharma in that way. Yes, as I said, he also has written the Eihei Shingi, which is he did a lot of work in establishing rules and guidelines. Instructions for monastic communities. He very much wanted to return to really the practice of the Buddha. From the beginning of Buddhism, monks have lived in community during the rains retreats, and training in Sangha, training within the context of a Sangha, has always been extremely important in Buddhism. And there always have been in Buddhism the four aspects of the Buddhist Sangha, the lay men and women and the monastic male and female monks. And so he wanted to build communities. He wanted to find ways of starting this in Japan in a way that it hadn't been, you know, to cut through some of the arguments, some of the fighting that had been happening, and to establish communities that could be serious about practice, and to really give help to the common people as well. He traveled about quite a bit in his early years, and it took him about 10 years to kind of settle, partly because of the difficulties in the country, partly because he was uncertain as to how he wanted to do things, apparently, and also he was trying very hard to keep the teaching pure, you know, so he sort of transported wholesale the Chinese practices, you know, and it didn't quite take completely. He didn't have a lot of monks coming to him at first wanting to train with him because it was a little foreign or a little strange, and yet some did because they saw beyond that and really wanted to find out, knew that there was indeed something really authentic within that. It took him a while to settle into Japan again, and eventually he did establish a monastery in the mountains, as his master had instructed him, in the deep valleys of Japan, which was called Eiheiji, which means a temple of eternal peace. And thus his name is now Eihei Dogen, you know, as a, He's basically named after the mountain and the temple, as well as his ordination name. So he did a great deal to begin this foundation in Japan of monastic communities and making it possible for monks to train together as they would have with the Buddha, and to make, in particular, all aspects of one's daily life a meditation practice and an expression of enlightenment. And that's perhaps one of the biggest aspects, the most important aspect of Soto Zen that has continued to this day, quite remarkably, is this teaching and this training of not looking for enlightenment in some other place. There had been a great deal of emphasis, even in China, on training to gain enlightenment experience, you know, training for Satori, you know, pushing people to get some kind of breakthrough, you know, and it happens sometimes, and we do need to get pushed, but there was this kind of sense of separation between the training and then the liberation itself, and also the study and the daily life. You know, there are these kind of separations that he observed, and they distressed him, and also, as I mentioned earlier, even within his own personal life, and so he worked very, very tirelessly to harmonize those in through his teaching, through his own individual practice, through his teaching, spoken and written, and also through training his monks and congregation in dropping body and mind, just sitting, just being present, and realizing that the Dharma is where you are right now, and de-emphasizing striving for some particular experience that's then going to put you into some other realm where you're going to be safe and forever know everything and you know, do everything right. And it seems silly, but we all have a bit of that, don't we? You know, we do that. But on the other hand, one doesn't just... obviously, there is a need for practice and diligence as well, but there was this middle way that he brought forward of harmonizing the ideal and the actual, the study, the enlightenment, and the training. And in fact, he went so far, as you have all read in the Zazen rules, to say that training and enlightenment are indeed one. That in fact, even if we don't think so or feel it is so, that this was his experience and that we should trust this. And we should trust that our small acts of training throughout the day are in fact themselves expressions of enlightenment. They are in fact the manifesting of enlightenment. So we don't have to be doing them for some other reason. You know, this is it right here. You're doing the best you can in your daily life. You're practicing kindness. You're following the precepts, doing as little harm as you can. You're being still. You know, you're listening. You're being of whatever help you can. This is, in fact, itself, when we're doing this without that looking for something else, in fact, becomes the very expression and manifestation of enlightenment. Of course, we're not going around thinking that we're always doing enlightened activity, right? That's a little different. But we're trusting something within ourselves, trusting that Buddha nature. The Buddha called it the unborn, the undying, unchanging, indestructible. Reverend Master Jiyu referred to it as the indestructible. Dogen talks a lot about Buddha nature. All the many Chan masters before him referred to it as Buddha nature. So in the Zazen rules, he says that just sitting with no deliberate thought is the important aspect of serene reflection meditation. So that's the important aspect, just sitting with no deliberate thought. So there's no problem with the thoughts or the feelings or the sensations that are arising, but we're not, we're doing our best to not engage in deliberate thought or deliberately doing something while we're sitting. And thus, the dropping off of body and mind, or as I sometimes see it or experience it, is a kind of evaporation process. So you can either see it as a dropping away, falling away, or as an evaporation, Maybe I've cooked a little, been around stewing pots a bit too much. But you put all your ingredients in there, you know, and sit still and trust. And then what needs to, you know, evaporate does so, and then you've got something quite delicious and nourishing, you know. And that's a lot like sitting, actually. So it's the deliberateness, just little by little backing off of the deliberate activity during the sitting, thus allowing what is there to come forth and to begin to show itself, express itself through everything that we think and do and feel and so on. Reverend Master Ji used to talk about the brain as being kind of a computer. I mean, we're very brain-driven in our Western culture, and nothing wrong with the brain. We need to use them. We need to think things through. Hopefully we do. But to think that the brain somehow is the foremost organ that should be governing everything or is the most important thing can get one into a lot of trouble and confusion. And she used to say it's more like a computer, and it doesn't work. You know, it has its function. It can help you figure things out when you need to. But unless it's plugged into the heart, it's of no use. And if it's trying to run the show, you get confused very quickly. You might, you know, you can get an awful lot of information out of it, but is it really useful or helpful? Does it actually help? Does it actually deal with the problem of suffering? And so when it's plugged into the heart, or the Buddha nature, if you like, when it finds its rightful place, it's very useful. So in the sitting, in the just sitting, we're settling into something deeper and allowing that to come forth as we let go of the engagement with deliberate thought. Now, this is what we do when we're just sitting. There obviously are times when you sit down and deliberately work something out. But as you learn to do this, the deliberateness in other areas of one's life becomes purified through this practice and through the practice of the precepts and becomes useful and helpful to others. It's interesting. Great Master Dogen was very, and his master, were very fond of the teaching of Great Master Hongji and strongly influenced by him. Reverend Master Mayon did a retreat on his teachings a while ago, and I'll just read you a little bit of his teaching along these lines, and you can see the parallels. He tried to bring this teaching back regarding meditation, regarding serene reflection meditation. Infinite wonder permeates this serenity. In this reflection, all intentional efforts vanish. Serenity is the final word. Reflection is the response to all. It's just a little snippet. The truth of serene reflection is perfect and complete. The hundred rivers flow in tumbling torrents to the great ocean and go where they need to go. So this serene reflection is the way that we have translated the meditation practice that Dogen was taught, and the Soto Zen practice, this balance of serenity and reflectiveness in one. So he was very interested in, he strongly emphasized this, practiced it as his master did, and did everything he could to encourage his disciples, both monastic and lay, to know that in fact they are at heart Buddha, and there's absolutely no reason why they themselves can't become Buddha if they can, you know, train themselves. And this was, I find his teachings, and when we think of him as the father of Soto Zen, I know in my years of training in this practice, actually have that feeling about him as a kind of father figure in my own training, because so many times works that I've read of his have helped me at times of difficulty, where I would remember some of the teaching that have pulled me out of difficulty. The incredible encouragement that he gives in his writings and just does not let up on until you really just let go and believe it, you know. I could say a great deal about his other aspects of his teaching, the important one being of practicing, you know, seeing the, bringing the Dharma to one's daily life and seeing the opportunities for enlightenment in everything that we do, and trusting our Buddha nature. I will just maybe conclude with one important teaching that is also very significant to him. As the Buddha did, he taught all four aspects of the Sangha, men and women, and this was sometimes quite different from cultural norms, but he didn't reject anybody. He taught all the various castes, you know, people from the outcasts, the people who were in the lowest caste were in the Sangha, people who were from noble families were in the Sangha, their seniority, their position in life had no effect on their seniority in the Sangha. The date of ordination was what mattered in the Sangha. Very interesting, very radical for his time. And Dogen also started something quite radical in Japan in that sense, and began to teach that, you know, men and women really were equals, in spiritual equals. There was no reason why, again, emphasizing the Buddhist teaching that any one of them, regardless of gender and so on, and background, couldn't realize the truth. And he taught this to his monks. And he was very strict with his monks if he saw them not honoring this, and in particular with regards to training women. At his time, he wouldn't have been able to have female monks in his monastery, but he did have, he didn't have any female disciples. I'm sorry, he didn't ordain any women, but he had female disciples who came from other traditions. They didn't practice in his monastery. They would have practiced in another place. But nonetheless, eventually that has led to what you have now in Japan, which is a much greater equality, although it has taken, I think, a good 750 years for that to be somewhat realized, even in Japan. According to one of the very great female Zen master that I met last year in Thailand when I was there, who was giving a talk on this subject. But now she says that she can travel and teach, and she's treated just like the men, which is very interesting and very encouraging. Well, Dogen says here in one of his writings called the Rai Hai Tokuzui, which means respectful bowing will secure for you the very marrow of the way. And this is a chapter from the Shobo Genzo that Reverend Master Hubert has translated. He says, when a female monk who has attained the way and realized what Dharma is becomes head of a temple, male monks who in seeking the Dharma wish to train under a master will join her community, respectfully bowing as they ask about the Dharma, for she's a splendid model for their training and study. It will be for the trainee like receiving something to drink when we are thirsty. So I just thought I'd put that in there. And this is certainly what Koho Zenji, Reverend Master Jiyu's master, taught. He was also very adamant about encouraging the equality of the sexes in this regard, and thus we had Reverend Master Jiyu herself able to come here and, in fact, do an awful lot for women trainees in Japan, too. She did a lot for the women's movement within monastic Sangha in Japan to help them have equal status or greater status. So this is a very, we're very fortunate to have him as our founder and the father of our tradition, and as the offertory that Reverend Berthold so sang so nicely says, his teaching and his example are for us as rain is for trees and grass. And that is how we receive the Dharma from him. Thank you.